And if you know some of the devil's people, you can bring them too. We'll be happy to see them, and we have a word for them. If you look at your folder a moment, the green folder, I want to just indicate that probably the last topic is going to get short shrift, but we will certainly deal with the topic of the centrality and vitality of the pastor. And if need be, we'll give the entire session in the afternoon to that. Now, also in your folder, you have something that looks like this, and I want to use this for just a moment. Hallowed be thy name in industry. Would you look at that side? Now, this is the picture of discipleship for the full people of God. And we've talked about how discipleship is a whole life thing. We've talked about how on the little triangle that we put up just before break, and that I don't know what page that's on in the paperback version, but it's on page 347 of the hardback version of The Divine Conspiracy. So you don't need to try to copy that down. If you have that book, you can just find it. But the idea here is, hallowed be thy name in industry, God be in my hands and in my making. Holy, 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 Lord of hosts, heaven and earth are full of thy glory. Hallowed be thy name in the arts. God be in my sense and in my creating. Holy, 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 Lord God of hosts, heaven and earth are full of thy glory. Hallowed be thy name in commerce. See, that's the king. That's bringing the kingdom of God where you are. In commerce, in governance. Now, you remember Paul's word to Timothy in 1 Timothy 2. First of all, then I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for everyone, for kings and for all who are in high positions. And you might want to just now flip that over, and let's look at the other side, and we'll come back to this. In the 20th century, as well as in the first century, we must bring the message of Christ to those who are in positions of leadership. And the reason for it is very simple. It is, they have a humanly impossible job. Would you remember that when you criticize your leaders? Now, why did Paul say pray for them? Because they have a humanly impossible job. They need to know God. And unless they know God and act in the power of His kingdom, they cannot do their work. The human problem has no human solution. And we do that sometimes to our pastors. The magical pastor we're looking for, who can wave his or her hand and all the problems will be solved. Well, the pastor has a humanly impossible job. And sad to say that many of our institutes for training pastors act as if it was simply a matter of training them to do certain kinds of things and then everything would go well. No, it will be a disaster. Maybe a dignified disaster, but it'll still be a disaster. Right? So now, see, one of our great dangers today is that we will not understand that the message is for the up and in as well as the down and out. And that we will not go to the up and in. and preach the gospel to them. And say to them, we're praying for you because we know what you need to get done. You cannot do in your own strength. See, now that would invite them to enter the kingdom. And we say, there is a way you can do what you need to get done. And that is by entering the kingdom of God. And now our problem is so much that we try to deal with a world of evangelism while plowing around non-Christian leaders and societal institutions. Go for the leaders. Pray for them. Speak to them. Treat them like they are human beings with impossible tasks. Have compassion upon them. And the truth is, sin and unfaith are luxuries which our physical limitations and social demands can no longer afford, and this is increasingly so. So all around the country we have nations that are depleting their resources just to stay afloat. And whole areas where they have lived, for example, on fishing, and the fisheries are dying. Now see, we have to understand what kind of problem that is. That's a problem with the human kingdom trying to run on its own. And so it very quickly becomes get what you can and the devil take the hindmost. That's true here in Africa. It's true in the United States. It's true in Brazil. It's true in Cambodia. That's where we have to address the message. They're not going to send someone off to some business school in London or Philadelphia or someplace else and they'll come back and solve that problem. They're good people trying to solve the problem. But what they always run up against is the limitations of human kingdoms. We have to reach the leaders. Not just to get them into heaven, but to teach them how to reign with Jesus Christ where they are. And heaven will take care of itself. Hallowed be thy name in government. Holy, 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 Lord God of hosts, heaven and earth are full of thy glory. Hallowed be thy name in education. Go back to some of the things we talked about last time. That statement by that lady about how education and our faith has come into conflict. See, that pastors have to take the leadership. You cannot leave the realm of ideas to unbelievers. And one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century is that the church has allowed the unbelieving person and world to define what counts as knowledge. Hallowed be thy name in the home. God be in my heart and in my loving. That's a wonderful prayer. That is exactly on target, you see, for whole life discipleship. Now then, we have to turn to this issue of spiritual formation and deal with it in some detail. So now this may be a little odd for you, but that's a picture of you. That's a picture of you. It's a kind of spiritual x-ray of you. And instead of picking out the heart and the lungs and all of that, it takes you as a whole person. Those are aspects of yourself. And when we talk about spiritual formation, again, we have to deal with the whole person. Spiritual formation is something that has to deal with every essential aspect of the human being. So now, at the very center of your life is your spirit. And that's the same thing as your heart or your will. And that is the place where you make decisions. That's the center of your being. Spirit is very tiny in the human being. You have very little of it, but it is who you really are. It's that part of you that God has made in terms of its nature like Him. God is spirit. He is infinite spirit. And He is a power that is so great that He can create the physical and spiritual universe that surrounds us. We have a very small element in us that is spirit. And this is like the executive center of the self. The main function of the spirit is to relate you to God. And if your spirit were functioning right, then you would live in full reliance on God. Now, those who are dead in spirit are still spiritual beings. Right? They don't start being physical beings just because they rebelled against God. They're still spiritual beings, but their spirit is dead because it is uprooted from God. And it is in a process of corruption. So Paul says that the mind of the flesh results in death. Remember Romans 8? The mind of the spirit in life and peace. Because the mind that is fixed on the flesh is precisely a mind that is turned away from God. So the mind of the flesh cannot please God, cannot satisfy the law of God, can't be subject to the law of God because it's turned to the wrong thing. They that sow to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruptions in Galatians 6. They that sow to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. See? Now, when the spirit turns away from God, then everything else goes crazy. And it becomes corrupted. The mind consists of your thoughts and your feelings. It's your thoughts and your feelings. And, of course, what you will depends upon your thoughts and your feelings. Because you can't will anything unless you have an idea of it. And a feeling about it. It's just that simple. Right? You have to have some idea if you're going to get a drink of water. Right? You have to know what water is and know where it is. But that's not enough to get you to go get a drink of water, is it? You have to have a feeling about it. And then you can go. If you have the feeling but you don't know where the water is, again, you're stuck. Right? You have to have both, thought and feeling. That's what the will, as it were, bounces off of. But the will can also be distortive of thought and feeling. It can be misdirected and misguided. And it can develop a character that's based upon the misdirection and the misguidedness. Now, of course, the body and the social dimension of the self, they are areas that are involved in our action and in our life. We don't have a body, we're not a human being. We don't have a social context, we're not a human being. We are inherently social beings. And now, as we grow up in a world that's turned away from God, not only our mind, but our body becomes habituated in ways that are against God. So you don't have to think long and hard to do something wrong. You're ready to do it. It's in your body. See, I mean, when Peter denied the Lord, and this was really an elaborate process of teaching, because Jesus said he was going to, and he said, no, I'm not going to do it. He said, well, I know what you're going to do. And so, no, I'm not going to do it. I'll die rather than deny you. And then he denied him, not just once. And you say, where did that come from? It came from his body and his social context. You see, as you go along, your life begins to run from that context and from your body. And then a lot of stuff gets located in there. And it can just be bad ideas and bad habits, or it can be demonic. It gets located in there. And your life begins to run from that. Now your soul is the part of you that makes all the rest of it work together and creates of the many parts one life. That's your soul. Soul is the deepest part of you in one sense, because it's the part that makes all the rest of it work together. If you have a broken soul, you're in real trouble. And frankly, most people have a broken soul. That's why they're non-functional. That's why Paul says, for example, the things I would that I do not, the things I would not that I do. The flesh lusteth against the spirit against the flesh. So you have a world full of people like Peter who say, oh no, I won't, and then they do it. Right? Now where does that come? Well, it comes out of that whole person there. So now see, when we start to talk about spiritual formation and discipleship, we're talking about transforming that whole area. It isn't enough for you to just say, oh, well, I really mean it. If that isn't transferred into your whole self, there'll be a moment when you don't really mean it. Because your actions and your life does not just come from your decisions. That's where Jesus in the garden, when he wanted some friends to pray with him while he prayed about what he was concerned with there, they went to sleep. And Jesus' statement about them was very diagnostic. It was, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. So you don't just live from your spirit. So when Peter was faced with the association with Jesus, he didn't think about it, did he? He didn't say, now, this is a situation in which I probably should deny the Lord. He didn't think, did he? Right? It just, whoosh, there it was. Well, see, the soul runs the whole operation. I like to compare the soul to a computer that runs a business operation. You don't pay any attention to it unless you want to extend it or change it, or it breaks down. You don't want to hear about the computer. You just want it to work. And it's supposed to deal with everything that's coming in and everything that's going out and everything that's happening. And that's the computer. That's the soul. And the soul is, it runs very much on its own, so much so that we often speak to it in the third person, you know, in the Psalms and in the Bible and in poetry. You speak to the soul in the third person, right? Why art thou cast down, O my soul? Why art thou disquieted within me? Hope thou in God. Thou shalt yet see the help of his countenance. Talking to the soul. The rich man, the rich fool. Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for thee for many years. Take thy rest. Thou fool, this night thy soul this night your computer is going to crash. And you're out of business. So we speak because it does very much run independently of our will. Now then, the great thing is that by grace, when the gospel comes into our heart and our mind, then we can actually do some reprogramming with God's assistance on the soul and on the social relations and on the body, see. And so, and that's really what spiritual disciplines are about. Now, you may need more than spiritual disciplines, various kinds of ministry. Certainly, you need to hear the gospel. Probably you need other kinds of ministry, but also there comes the point where God says to us, now we've come this far, now what's your plan? What are you going to do? And that's the point at which you have to begin to learn more than you probably ever wanted to know about the computer. So here's a picture of the self now. And the main thing you have to understand is that spiritual formation is a matter of dealing with all of that. Because your life, while it runs from the center, doesn't run only from the center. Right? So here's another little diagram here that can help us. This, we look at it here from the point of view of actions. Where do your actions come from? Well, they come out of the center, your will. You see, your will is under the pressure of your body, of your soul, of your social situation, of your mind, of your feelings. So if your will is ever going to work rightly, you have got to make sure that the rest of this stuff is in order. And when you come to the Lord, the Lord's going to do wonderful things for you. But there's going to come a point where he's going to say, now what are you going to do? Right? I like to use the story of Israel coming into the promised land because it's such a good illustration here. You know, the walls of Jericho fell down. Was there any other cities that their walls fell down? What'd they have to do? They had to take them. Inch by inch. Why didn't the Lord just make all the walls fall down? Why didn't he? Why didn't he just transform you into Tinkerbell? He could do that, couldn't he? Sure. You know, he could just make an angel out of you right now. But see, that does not form what he is most concerned about, and that is character. Character comes by experience, choice, dealing with consequences, learning, growing, and you cannot form character without that. And God is in the business of forming character because, as I said, his object is to get you to the point to where he can empower you to do what you want. And that only character will make that possible. And the most precious fruit of the earth is human being with the character of Christ. And remember that now when you ask, why in the world does all the awful stuff that happens happen? It is so that God can achieve his aim of bringing out of earth a community of people, a vast community of people, with the character of Jesus Christ. Isn't that scriptural? Right? I mean, he's bringing many sons, many daughters to redemption. Jesus is our big brother. That's what it's about. So now, you have to realize here that sometimes you have an action and it'll come mainly from your body. Or mainly it may, for example, I mean, here's Esau. Right? Esau, he's been out hunting. He comes in and says the typical thing, "I'm going to die of hunger." No, he wasn't about to die of hunger. He just wasn't in control of his belly. His belly was running him. And you see that elsewhere in his life. In his body. So you say, "Oh, what's my birthright worth if I die? And so give me some of them red beans and you can have my birthright." What a fool. His body was running his life. And there are many people in our world today that think that's the way it's supposed to be. You ever look at the magazines at the counter? I guess you have them here. You see all those pictures on the front? And over it, it says, "Blessed are the skinny." Isn't that right? "Blessed are the young. Blessed are the hairy." Right? "Blessed are the rich." Isn't that what it says? That's what it says, isn't it? See, these are people who, in Paul's language, their God is their belly. A thin belly, in that case. So then you have some from the social realm. Shame. Young people suffer terribly here, you see, because they're so conscious of the social relation. And they're apt to become bulimic. Or they're apt to kill themselves. Or some combination of these. And then you have people whose ideas are fixed or their emotions are running their life. Now, see, that's basically the world you're up against. Feeling. A lot of people live for their feelings. Some combination of body and emotion. And that's actually pretty deep. The human life really requires drama. Because drama is the flow of meaning in life. And people can become very desperate. And this is important for pastors, because pastors can take wrong courses and begin to think of their life in a way that drains their life of everything but drudgery. We have to have feeling. But feeling is to be a servant and not a master. And in our world, it's very largely a master. See, I can give you the secret of drug addiction in one word. Feeling. That's it. And of course, rather elaborate feelings that often have what appears to be drama. See, the person who is hooked on alcohol is the person who wants to party, wants that feeling. I mean, no one would drink it because of its taste. It tastes awful. I still remember as a boy when I had my first swallow of Old Crow. I thought I was going to croak on Old Crow. Slightly better than kerosene. But now, why did I do it? Well, that was the social dimension that was driving them. But then if a person goes on that route, then they'll get where they need what comes after swallowing the Old Crow. When they begin to feel that buzz. So the person on cocaine, or they want that, or sex. Or power. They all have that kick. So we have to understand now that our actions come out of a very complicated system, and if these get out of balance enough, the soul is broken. The soul gets broken. And then the parts don't work together at all. Remember, the soul is what integrates it all into one life. And that's why you see so many people who don't have one life. They have two or three. And they don't fit together. So now spiritual formation is designed to put this back together. And, of course, the crucial thing here is the Word and the Spirit of Christ enters. And it enters. I don't have this arrow drawn rightly. If I had it drawn rightly, I'd have the arrow stopping here and then maybe dot, dot, dot going on into the Spirit. The Word and the Spirit come to the mind. They come in a way that affects both feeling and thought. I mean, here, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The kingdom of heaven being at hand is a thought. How is it at hand? It's at hand in the person of Jesus Christ. And the person of Jesus Christ, once you look at him, elicits immense feeling. See? And now then, since that's there, the Spirit and the Word can be received, and the will can begin to act differently, and the primary act is placing faith in Christ, the backside of which is establishing communion with God. Now, if you're worried about prevenient grace and all of that, don't worry about it. I mean, this is something that only happens because the grace of God accompanies every move. But you see, we're not waiting on grace. The grace is there. We're waiting on us. Bill.
I think for the average person, there's a great difficulty distinguishing between spirit and soul.
Right.
Yeah,
the basic problem there is both spirit and soul are spiritual in the sense of being non-physical. That's the confusing point. The soul is not a physical entity. But the difference is the soul is not what makes decisions. The faculty of decision-making is different from soul. That's why Trevor's dogs have soul, but they don't have spirit. Soul is much more pervasive than spirit. Spirit is personal. It is the faculty of choice. Now, that's why, so you know, in my environment, there's a big effort to get something, for goodness sakes, that will talk. A dolphin, a monkey, or something that will talk somehow, you know. You know. That doesn't bother me. I mean, if you had a talking dolphin, that'd be great. Or if they talk all the time, or if whales sing legends, that's okay. More power to them. When they find a whale that worships, or when they find a whale that deliberates about the future and makes decisions, see, your dog thinks, but your dog does not worry about whether or not he has sufficient bones laid up for his declining years. Don't do that. Now, you see, when you get over there, you're into the area of spirit. You're into the area of choice. And choice and decision is the function of the spirit. Now, interestingly, the spirit can become enslaved to where it simply does what it's told by its belly or its social environment. In that case, you have a spirit that is non-functional, and its only hope is to reestablish its relationship to God. It means something.
Yeah, in that context, then how do you understand
it? It discerns the difference between what is coming from the soul and what is coming from the spirit. And in particular, it's talking about what comes from God and what just comes from nature.
From the natural part.
The natural part, the soul. Mm-hmm. Now, you find some very good discussions of that in a lot of writers. The one I like best is Bonhoeffer in Life Together. He had a wonderful discussion of the difference between soul and spirit. See, I'm hoping that you can go away from here and say, you know what it is. Right? Because there is in you a dimension of yourself which organizes all the rest. And that's natural to you. Now, if you're worried about Trevor's dogs being immortal, no soul is immortal by nature. Souls are immortal because God keeps them in existence. Right. God keeps them in existence. So that's why you will continue to exist, is because God is invested in you. God has plans for you. And God likes you. Right? I mean, you probably have wished that you could keep some of your animals in existence. You were attached to them. But at a certain point, you had to give them up. Well, you know, that's a part of our finitude. We have to give them up. So now, here's the key moment. The key moment comes when the Word and Spirit of Christ has entered and we've accepted it in our heart. We've been born again from above and reestablished communion with God. And God says to us, now what are we going to do about the rest of it? What are we going to do about the rest of it? So you made the wall fall down around Jericho. You're in the promised land. Now go to work. What are we going to do about the rest of it? It isn't going to happen to you one day because you attended a wonderful service. Now, attending a wonderful service may help you a lot. That's not going to do this. Let's look at 2 Peter 1. And the New Testament now is full of this part of the story. And if we're going to minister to our age, we have to include this. And this is a significant part of what we do as teachers and pastors, is get people on the road to the full possession of the self by Christ. As Paul says in Galatians 4:19, tell Christ be formed in you. Right? That's spiritual formation. That's a good biblical watchword for spiritual formation. But now let's spell it out some. Listen to this. Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and Jesus our Lord, seeing that his divine power has granted unto us everything pertaining to life and godliness. That's the walls of Jericho right there. Through him, the true knowledge of him who called us to his glory and excellence, by his glory and excellence. For by these things he has granted to us his precious and magnificent promises, in order that you might become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust, desire, epithumia. Really, it's obsessive desire. It isn't like desire in the sense that you'd like to have a drink of water. It's epithumia, that is obsessive desire. Desire which breaks the order of the self in its relationship to God. Now, here we go. Now, for this very reason also, applying all diligence. How much diligence? All diligence. Don't let up. Give it all. in your faith, now some of your versions will read to your faith, add, and that's actually quite adequate. This, I use the New American Standard Version normally because it's a little more picky about things, and it's not good, often hardly good English, but it's struggling to get the nuances. Add, in your faith, supply moral excellence. Character. And one of the things this teaches is you can have faith and not character. And in your moral excellence, add knowledge. Now you can think of it like this. Character means you have good habits. But you may not understand. So you need to add knowledge to your good habits. Because good habits can be thrown into confusion, and sometimes we need to know. And add to your knowledge self-control. Now self-control is the ability to do what you intend to do. Isn't that what self-control is? It's the ability to... Now, see, we're moving past the place where the things I would, that I do not. And the things that I would not, that I do. Remember that? Now, a person who has self-control is a person who is established in his knowledge and virtue in such a way that he or she can simply do without a lot of hoofla and effort and sweat, just do it. And that's based on knowledge and habit. That's what goes into the training. Add in your self-control perseverance. That is, you don't just have self-control on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You have it all the time. And you stay with it. And then, on top of that, godliness. See? You have the depth of character. You have the power that goes into being like God. Are you ready to be like God? That's what godliness is. It's to be godlike. Now, the divine nature has been imparted to you through the new birth. And what you're doing now is you're taking that through that whole self. So that in your body and in your social relationships and all of you, that's how you're growing. And now you're ready for Philadelphia. Not the city, but the condition. Brotherly kindness. Brotherly kindness. That means that you are able to be genuinely kind and loving to those who are close to you. How many of you know that ain't easy? And in one way or another, most of us fail at it in our families. And we've been failed by others in our families. And most of us were raised in families where they're really... Brotherly kindness really wasn't there. But now we're able to do that. And then finally, with these progressions, agape is always at the top. Agape is always at the top. And this completes the progression. Now you'll find that true in the progression in Romans 5. You remember where you come to the final place there. The love of God is shed abroad in our hearts by the Spirit which He's giving. Right. Now, the interesting thing about Romans 5 is that is presented as a progression which we are put through. Romans 5 does not say, you do it. And you have to combine these and get them both together, the active and the passive. Because it is not going to be done for you. But when you do it, it will only be because other things are at work than you. See, and so then in Colossians 3 and similar passages in Paul about putting off the old person and the new person. You put off the old person and his deeds. Him that created him. And immediately you just start out right with the hardest part of all. That is, ignoring the differences between people, in which there is no Greek, no Jew, no circumcision, no uncircumcision, no barbarian, no Scythian, no bond, no free, but Christ is all and in all. Put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels, innards, guts. What's that? That's where your life comes from. You put on bowels of mercies, kindness, humility of mind, meekness, long-suffering. If anyone has a quarrel with any, even as Christ forgave you, so also forgive them. And now what comes next? Above all these things, put on agape, which is the bond of perfectness. That is, when you get perfect, you tie it together with a ribbon of agape. And that'll hold it together. Among other things, you won't be troubled with pride or arrogance. Agape will take care of that. See, that's the progression. Bill.
Dennis, just a point of interest. Passage from Peter was one of the three passages that Wesley read the morning of his conversion.
Is that right? I had no idea of it. That's great. And it does have the whole, that I think it's one of the most complete passages because it starts out with the gift and what has been given to us, the as the old version says, exceeding great and precious promises. And then says, now add, give all diligence. And one can sure see that in Wesley's working out how he combined those. Also the great Philippians verse, you know, where it talks about working out your salvation with fear and trembling. Not working to, but working out. I didn't know that. That's a wonderful thing. And good for us to use as a model. Someone back here had a...
Does anyone understand it? Perhaps I'm misunderstanding. I read an article, the journal article that you wrote, concerning, I think it's probably summarizing what you've been saying, concerning a discipleship as opposed to the label that we have, Christian, making people Christian rather than disciples. The thing that I struggle with in my mind, strong focus on sanctification, on the process of formation. How do you then, I mean, I don't have a problem with that, but where does justification fit in your thinking?
Mm-hmm.
In that process of calling people not to become Christians, but to become disciples of Christ, and to begin the journey of formation. That's how I understand what you're saying. Tell me if I'm wrong. Where then, do the lines between justification and sanctification gray?
Well, there is no line. They are part of one process. That process is called faith in Jesus Christ. Faith does not justify and leave sanctification in question. Right. See, that's the problem with the Christianity without discipleship picture. It is that you can accept the saving merits of Christ by believing the right things about Him and leave aside the issue of obedience to Christ. There is no line. And there is no line because it's all one thing. Confidence in Jesus Christ. So the whole gospel is what? Trust Jesus. That's it. See, now this is what I said yesterday when I said you have people who say they can trust Jesus for the forgiveness of sins, but not for a sandwich. You can trust Jesus for forgiveness of sins, but remain in serious doubt as to whether or not it is on the whole best for me to love my enemies. That is psychologically impossible. Unless you've had a lot of teaching. And see, I do think that many people who are confused about a lot of things are going to make the cut and get into heaven. See, I have no worry about that because I'm sure I'm wrong about a lot of stuff, and I'm sure I'm going to be there. Right, so you can be confused about a lot of things, and with a teaching, if a teaching comes down to you and says, now justifying faith is one thing and sanctification is another, then you're probably going to have to limp through life and stumble into heaven on that teaching. And again, you may have to wear a dunce cap for a few million years, but while you sort of catch up, you know. You have to, what do we call those courses? Bridging courses. That's a lovely word. You folks are so nice. We have other words for those. Actually, we're in such bad shape in the United States on education that some of our universities have almost busted their budget by taking in students who they then have to get ready to be in. And there's in California a big decision recently to stop doing that because otherwise, well, what we have there now is people who are having to go 6 years to get a four-year degree because they can't get the courses because the courses aren't taught because they're having to teach people who shouldn't be there in the first place. Well, of course, heaven can handle that. It's got the resources. They'll be able to take care of it, but we used to have courses called dumbbell English or dumbbell math, which is... Okay, now, if you've got the general idea, right, This is the process of spiritual formation. The process of spiritual formation is the transformation of the whole self. The whole self, because the will does not just operate on its own. And the human person is meant to operate as a whole being. By the way, the unit of analysis here is the person. You know, these things don't lie about like the parts of your car. You know, they don't. You don't have a piston over here and a wheel over there. You know, in you, you are one person. These are dimensions of abilities. See, the unit of analysis is the person. These are not separable. Is what I'm saying to you. Can't separate them. They don't mean anything if you try to separate them. And so the whole person now is the unit of analysis. And I want to emphasize just once more now before I turn to say a little bit about disciplines. See, we've got going here the action of the Holy Spirit, the ordinary events of life. Then we have this dimension over here under the action of the Holy Spirit. This would involve everything from the preaching of the gospel under the anointing of the Spirit to deliverance ministries, to psychological counseling, to ongoing fellowship in the body of believers, maybe your cell groups. And again, here you can't really draw the line between what's a discipline and what's not. You can have a general idea, but as I'll explain in a moment, a lot of different things could count as disciplines. The main thing about disciplines is they are purposefully chosen activities that enable me to do what I cannot do by direct effort. And now here, for example, the ordinary events of life, I may not purposefully choose those. Or there may be some element of choice. For example, helping with the housework. Now that might be a point of contention. Somebody's got to do it. So, for example, one might undertake that as a discipline of service. I will put this up. I'll do that now, since Timpus is fidgeting. And what I just said is the second paragraph. It's a consciously chosen, I see I didn't get it in that version. It's a consciously chosen activity that enables me to do what I cannot do by direct effort. Now that idea is one that works in all areas of life. Everything from lifting weights to learning to speak a language, or, you know, if you want to be able to speak a language, you have to go through a lot of stuff, making sounds and learning how to articulate and all that. You exercise. If you don't exercise, you'll never learn to speak the language. And the same thing is true of lifting weights, though there is more involvement of the body still. With speaking the language, there's involvement of the body too. You have to teach your muscles how to make the sound. So just to start with, the spiritual disciplines, or disciplines for the spiritual life, used by disciples of Jesus throughout the history of his church, are only a systematization and extension, though they're not always wisely done, of practices followed by Jesus and his earlier friends in New Testament times. A discipline is an activity that enables us to accomplish what we cannot do by direct effort. So again, watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. So, now, that temptation, you know, is before you get to the sin. And if you want to stay out of the sin, best way is to stay out of temptation. Watch and pray to stay out of temptation. Now, do you think if they had done that, they would have avoided denying Christ? I think very likely. Running, watch and pray, stay out of temptation. Now see, in thinking about sinning, you have to understand the thought of sin is not a temptation. The awareness of the possibility is not a temptation. You have to have that plus the inclination to do it. That's temptation. That's not yet sin. Sin is where you have that inward yes. You may still have not done it, but you're ready to do it. And when the occasion is right, you will. See, I often tell my students in ethics, a thief is not someone who steals. A thief is someone who would steal. And if the situation were right, they would steal. That person has the soul of a thief. Because they have said the inward yes. Now, of course, the person who has said, no, I won't, still has to carry through with the good intention, and that gets us into the other areas of the self, but that's where you start with saying no. And then if you really want to avoid it, what you do is you train yourself where, as we say, it's unthinkable. That means even when I think about it, I don't want to think about it. Even if I'm not inclined, I don't want to think about it. And one of the blessings of mass media is it enables people to think of so many things they shouldn't even think of. They shouldn't have those images. They shouldn't be able of thinking about things. See, and that's why it's so important, these issues like pornography and so on. It's so important to try to get rid of it, because it falls into the hands of a young person especially, and then they can think things they couldn't have thought before. And one can say, well, but what about freedom of thought? Well, I have freedom to let pigs and horses run through my house, but I'm not going to do it. And I'm not going to let some stuff run through my mind. And if I can see it coming, I'll shut the door. See? That's a part of discipline. A disciplined person simply will not think some things. Okay, well, let's talk. We have a half an hour to talk some about particular disciplines and how important these are. Now, first of all, let me make a few general remarks. There's no complete list of disciplines. And that's why it's important that you understand the concept and not just get the list. See? And one of the problems in our various traditions is usually a tradition of any length will come with a list. And that list will usually be imposed as a kind of legalism. And so then we need to say something else. These are not works of righteousness. You don't do these because they are good in themselves. I want to say that again. None of those are good in themselves as disciplines, at least. You get over to the right side, you have some that have another reason for doing them than discipline, for example, prayer and worship. And they are good in themselves, but not as disciplines. See, that's why you don't want to get your church service to in the minds of your people as something that they have to do to be good. Some years ago, a very well-known pastor in the Los Angeles area said to his people in the morning service, you know, he said, when you don't come to church in the evening, it makes my stomach hurt. Because I work hard to prepare these sermons, and you don't come. It makes my stomach hurt. Now, you know, if you just think about it, that might not be a leading reason for coming to the evening service. To keep the pastor's stomach from hurting. Right? I mean, there's probably some other good reason for that. And you might be a little bit angry and say it makes my stomach hurt, but that's not a good reason for your people coming. You know, you can just see the family gathering and say, well, we must go keep the pastor's stomach from hurting. So, these are not works of righteousness. See, they're wisdom. Wisdom is different from works of righteousness. Wisdom is, it's good for you. It's good for you. Ideally, we would practice them to where we didn't need them that much. And a good rule as to whether or not you need a discipline is how hard it is for you to practice. If you find it's very hard for you to go into solitude and do nothing, that's probably what you really need to do. And that's a big one for pastors especially. doing nothing is probably the greatest challenge to your faith that you'll ever have. But when you get there, you will experience a great power and liberation. Because one of your greatest temptations is you're going to try to do too much. You're going to try too hard. And solitude is designed to pry you free from that. And to allow you to know that the world, after all, doesn't depend on you. Because when you get back, it'll still be there. Well, let's talk a little bit about solitude now. It's a very important discipline, and I think in many ways I'd say it is the primary discipline for the person who is entering a path of purposive spiritual growth, spiritual formation. Just because of the misunderstanding is so common, I just need to emphasize, this is not something you're doing on your own. God will be with you in all of this, and what will come out of it will be the fruit of His presence, and not something you have produced by human effort. But I repeat, if you don't do something, it will not happen. See, God is ready. We're not waiting on God. We're waiting on us. What are we going to do? Right. So now, solitude is one of the very fundamental spiritual disciplines, or disciplines for the spiritual life. You see that in the life of Jesus. Especially in the early parts of the gospel, you'll notice that he spent long periods of time alone. Sometimes he was praying, but not always. There's a very important relationship between prayer and solitude, which is you're not going to get much practice done until you've practiced enough. You're not going to get much prayer done until you've practiced enough solitude to allow you to easily and deeply immerse yourself in prayer. And I found this is one of the things that I personally found many, many years ago that drove me deeper into thinking about this. I realized that I had to be alone enough that I could set everything else that was absorbing me aside and pray. Because I'm like most people of my background, I thought this was it, see? But I didn't know that these were disciplines. I didn't know what a discipline was. I thought this is what you do. You study, you worship, you celebration, serve, pray, have fellowship. Not so much confession and submission. That was a little too Catholic for me. But the other stuff, that's where you go. See, these disciplines of engagement, well, just drop the discipline and get the engagement. But what I found was, there's a whole lot of faking going on in these areas. Do you know that? I found, for example, because I was in Bible-believing churches, I found that most people believed their Bible but never really read it. And they'd much rather read Time magazine. Right? And prayer, well, everyone felt guilty. I should pray more. I learned, especially preachers, you could get them under guilt faster that way than anything else. Now, ordinary people, they didn't much expect to do with that. So, for example, the big guilt button there was soul winning and witnessing. So you could really get them going on that. And if you were trying to get people to do things, and you go to all these buttons, and you'll have some very worried people doing very worried things. So I had to learn now this whole principle of discipline, that in order to make these work as practices, you have to start here. And then actually you come back to these in a very different spirit, both in terms of what they are as disciplines and what they are as ministries or activities that God requires of us or gives to us as a part of our work with Him. The solitude, I had to learn that Jesus practiced solitude. I had to look at that and think about it. I had to get beyond the idea that, well, it was okay for him, but not for me. I had to think the thought that if he needed it, maybe I needed it. 40 days in the wilderness. I love the way Mark puts it, with the wild beast. What is he doing with the beast? You know, if you're going to save the world, why are you messing around with beasts? Angels, too. Angels were there with the wild beast and the devil. They all go together. And actually, you need to sort of enter into Jesus' experience, and there are a lot of things to be said here about it, because very, very clear this was a preparation for his entering into the full role of leadership. And we need to ask ourselves, if I'm going to enter into leadership, what do I need to learn in the wilderness, in solitude, in silence? What do I need to learn? Now the problem is always, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for this. Now, where does that come from? That comes from assuming too much responsibility. The real truth is, you don't have time not to do it. Because if you go without this, then all of the time you invest is going to have less and less return. Because solitude establishes your habit of dependence on God. Essentially, in solitude, you turn the world loose. And we have to do that. See, that's experience in giving our kingdom over to God. We have to step out of our normal relationships to other people, especially with those of us who are in, we say, responsible positions. Everyone is. But we have to step out of the situation where people are coming, say, you do this, you do that, you do that, you do this, you do this, you do this. And I'm expecting this of you, and you just have to step out of that. And solitude will cure you of busyness. And I wish that you would never be busy again. I wish that you would never be in a hurry again. And if you're not, you will find that you're far less worried. Worry is not a good thing for you. You see, you learn to turn yourself and your world loose, your reputation. Because if you go into solitude, people are going to say, he must not be busy. Important people are supposed to be busy. Did you know that? If you're not busy, you're not important. That's one of the things that brings people bounding out of solitude at a high rate of speed. is the thought, I am not important. Why am I here doing nothing? Eugene Peterson picks up a statement of C.S. Lewis's. I think it's in The Contemplative Pastor, in which Lewis says, only lazy people are busy. You ever hear that? Only lazy people are busy. What could he possibly have in mind? Well, what he's referring to, the fact is that people who are busy do not invest their energy in decision making. They don't invest their energy in decision making. They let people decide what they're going to do. That's easy, isn't it? Just do what people want you to do. It's hard to be responsible for your time. It's easy to let other people write your schedule. Solitude is a discipline that enables you to be able to, enables you to begin to schedule your time honestly before God. Now, in your little green folder, or red, or whatever it is, I've placed something that looks like this. And I want to bring this before you now, and we'll return to touch on it in the discussion this afternoon. If you fill your calendar with the important appointments, you will have no time for God. If you fill your spare time with essential reading, you will starve your soul. You mean I should do non-essential reading? Yes. If you fill your mind with worry about budgets and offerings, the pains in your chest and the ache in your shoulders will betray you. If you try to conform to the expectations of those around you, and see, that's where we get busy, because we have no place to stand other than the expectations of those around us. You will forever be their slave. Work a modest day, step back and rest, and this will keep you close to God. Now, you will not be able to do this unless you practice solitude. You will not be able to do it. And of course, I'm happy if you can. But unless you have practiced solitude to the point to where you stop jerking, you know, you're at peace and you're at rest, you won't be able to do this. I want to come back to this in the later discussion. But see, that's the role. Solitude also cures you from loneliness, because it will teach you that you are never alone. In solitude, you discover that you actually are something. You have a soul. And you're apt to forget that if you don't practice solitude. In solitude, you discover that you have a soul. Now, in solitude, a lot of things will happen if you practice solitude. But you don't want to try to make them happen. Because if you do, you'll turn solitude into work. Right? And the main thing about solitude is to get you off of work. Now, you add silence to solitude. Nouwen says somewhere that, Henry Nouwen says somewhere that silence completes solitude. You see, if you take a lot of noise in with you, you won't get free. You have to also enter into silence. Now, there is no way that one can convince you that these will help you. You have to practice them. They will verify themselves to you. And if you don't practice them, you can find many reasons for saying this is a bunch of baloney. But when you do begin to practice them, you will begin to experience God and yourself and your world and your work and your family in a completely different way. Now, silence has both the dimension of no noise and, under that, no talking. Because when you talk, you make noise, of course. that those are slightly different aspects. Both of them have a very helpful, strengthening kind of effect on your soul. And again, you need to be willing to venture and practice these, be experimental, learn from your experience. Sometimes when you begin to practice a discipline, things get very rough and you need to back up. Don't be a hero. This one of the most important general things you have to say about any discipline is do not be a hero. And if it's very hard, stop, back up, talk with your friends, talk with God, try to learn what went wrong. It is not true that where there's no pain, there's no gain. There's lots of gain with no pain, and there's lots of pain with no gain. And see, that's the sort of the hero mentality. It's just, well, I'm going to... No, forget it. You know, go do something else if it comes down to that, because that will hurt you. If you succeed with it, it will be a matter of pride. I don't know how many people I know who have tried heroic fasts and for some reason had to give them up just before they completed the time they had set. I'm sure God is saving them from pride. Of course, one of the great benefits of God's work in our soul is that we learn to accept failure. And if we take these disciplines as ways of succeeding, God will help us fail and help us through our failure. So, in solitude and silence, we break the hold of our surrounding world on us. And we establish a connection between us and God that frees us up then to re-enter normal human relationships, but now anchored in God. Now anchored in God. So, for example, if we are in a situation like Peter's where we're under duress because of social pressure, and don't tell me you don't know what that is. It doesn't always come in the form of denying Christ explicitly, you see. But if we're anchored in God, then we can stand and we can say no or yes without having to get upset and hostile and angry at ourselves or others, feeling pressure, as we say, or we can just be calm and do what we know to be right because we're anchored in God. See, the point of solitude is to bring out of that a different kind of foundation for our lives. Now, I just have a few minutes to talk about some of these others. See, fasting. Fasting means going without food in some measure or possibly drink. The point of fasting is to teach us that God sustains our body directly without the normal round of food and drink that He has provided. Fasting is the affirmation.